Chapter 5. Flash Memories. One day, Archimedes and Sean were surprised by a special visitor to their upstairs dockfront workshop.
"So, Archimedes, have you and the metal merchant come up with the goods?"
It was the young king himself.
"Your Majesty, this is indeed a great honour."
And the two bowed to the floor and almost beyond as Archimedes slipped on some oil.
"Is the death ray ready?"
asked the teenager in a strangely unenthusiastic way.
"I will let my apprentice answer," said Archimedes airily.
"Who, me?" surprised out Sean, but rallied to say, "Yes, of course, Archie, I mean Master. This way, please, your high and mighty Majesty. As you can see from this window, on the dock front we have 1,000 giant glass combs, each the size of a horse, lined up and ready. On your order, 5,000 slaves will start rubbing them like crazy with woolen jumpers, producing a magic energy known as electricity."
"Lick a turkey?" said the king. "Strange name."
"I told you it was a terrible name," whispered Archimedes to Sean.
Then to the king,
"Could I suggest we rename this new, powerful emanation Hieronymus's Breath, in your honour, your Majesty?"
ingratiated Archimedes.
"Or even the Evil Breath of Hieronymus, to instill fear in the hearts of our enemies," suggested the king.
Sean went on commendably straight-faced.
"All the combs are connected by copper wiring to a central point to provide the energy to excite the crystal. Above this point is an array of Archimedes mirrors to focus the sun's rays to where they would be amplified 1,000 times in the core of the device."
"Which is?"
"Your Majesty's giant ruby."
Sean pointed at the large red ruby hanging from its chain around the king's neck.
"And that is your lazy?"
"Yes, your highly esteemed Majesty. All we need to do is put your ruby in place, align the crosshairs on the aiming mirrors, and the weapon is ready." The king did not seem as enthusiastic as one would expect of a king who has just heard that his kingdom was safe from certain invasion. The silence was broken eventually by Archimedes.
"May we have the ruby now, your Majesty?"
"That's what I came here to talk to you about," began the king slyly. "First tell me something. If the ruby were not in place, if for some reason it were, say, stolen the night before the Romans attacked, say, by someone the guards wouldn't dare stop or challenge, and would obey if told to turn their backs for a few moments, and anyway, if the ruby were not in place, would the lazy still work?"
Sean answered, "No, your Majesty. The ruby is the core of the device, and its absence would make everything else as pointless as Master Archimedes' jokes."
"Or as tasteless as an Archimedean pie," inappropriated the man in question.
"See what I mean, your Majesty?"
"I do indeed." The king stood gazing out at the harbour, now quiet before the storm, and began to talk more to himself.
"With this weapon, Syracuse would become the most powerful city on the Middle-earth Sea. Uncle Adrenodorus has been a good teacher. I like it that I'm so young, yet I already know everything I need to know. I see things perfectly clearly. I see, for example, that Uncle Adrenodorus wants to be king himself, but I have my own plans. I will apply his principles better than even he."
"In what way?"
asked Archimedes, hooked by tenters.
"Oh, it is a surprise, a big surprise for everybody, but really ingenious and all my very own idea, or at least it was, eventually."
He absent-mindedly fondled a parchment projecting slightly from the inside pocket of his diamond-studded regal robe.
"You see, there is an alternative to fighting the Romans."
Archimedes said,
"Your Majesty, in our enlightened days, politics is a very streamlined business. The reigning business model dictates that we have to fight someone. It's either Carthage or Rome. And your uncle prefers to side with Carthage because Hannibal has won many engagements this year in southern Italy."
The king shook his adolescent head.
"Yes, and if we declare against Rome, Carthage has promised us help." "Help? But I want more than help."
"More than help from the most powerful nation in the world?"
"Yes. That is what my uncle wants, what my people want, but not what I want. What I want is to be safe. Safe means, of course, rich. I know my uncle plans to murder me. A great king must have the power to make people afraid of him."
"Are you not powerful now?" asked Archimedes.
Not enough. I need to be rid of my enemies, and I know how to gain that power and be rid of them at one stroke.
Your Majesty.
Yes, Archimedes. You are powerless because you seek knowledge above all else. Forever uncertain, poor old man. I, instead, am clear about what I need to know in advance.
Yet again Hieronymus's hand touched the parchment roll in his pocket, still bearing its priority C-line, urgent delivery stamps.
That is what my good friend Cespulio the Younger says.
The Roman consul? But he has sworn to audit Syracuse with a 50,000-man trade delegation.
The king continued. Even if all my own people are my enemies, I have friends outside who love and admire me, who wish to see me a strong ruler. Others may call it being a puppet, but strings pull in two directions. I see it as a joint venture. I like the phrase disproportionate returns. All I need to do is cross the Rubicon one night soon, and all my troubles will be over, and the great reign of Hieronymus of the Rapturous Returns will start afresh under the protection of a powerful corporate logo, the Eagle.
But, sire, your people?
Oh, no. My friends have explained it all to me. It is not betrayal to betray someone who has betrayed you first.
Even he realized he had said too much, and awkwardly changed the subject.
And what is this?
He went over to the opposite window.
What is this machine? A catapult?
Yes, your Majesty. It is a captured Roman onager I was just about to test, replied Archimedes.
Now, what does it project exactly?
Projectiles.
Ah, brilliant. What will you R&D chaps come up with next?
The king leant over the machine, his hand playing with the trigger pin absent-mindedly. He tried the giant ruby in the sling pouch for size.
I would recommend caution, my liege. It is loaded.
You seem to forget, old man, that I am omnipotent. My name, is it not, is Hero.
The king hit the trigger pin impatiently to stress his words.
Nemo!
The catapult twanged, and the carrier flew forward, taking the ruby and, by virtue of the neck chain, the brat king with it and out the window. This meant that the last half of his name was spread all over the town, as would be his royal person after a short parabola-described delay, while the king took his place in some corner of historical footnotes that will be forever Hieronymus.
So endeth the lesson, said Archimedes.
Sean and Archimedes watched the first human flight philosophically from the workshop window, the king's diamond-studded cloak billowing cometically behind him.
Archie, said Sean after a while, correct me if I'm wrong, but those 100 heavily armed battle triremes weren't there a few minutes ago, were they?
Oh dear, the show's about to start and the ruby is flying out there.
Quick, we have to get out of here, Archie.
It's too late. The Romans are landing.
Suddenly whistling could be heard and explosions as oil-filled projectiles exploded against the dockside buildings. At Archimedes' house, they found the 5 Time Riders waiting for them.
Sean, said Pau unsympathetically, I'm happy to say this is where we say goodbye. Bye-bye, mocked the other boys.
4 of the Time Riders were sitting cross-legged in a circle, each with their own egg in front of them. But Jenny ran to Sean and hugged him.
Come on, Jenny, called Pau, not without jealousy. You insisted on seeing the Mono before we leave. You've seen him, so let's go.
Jenny started to cry. We can't just leave him. The Romans will be here any minute. We don't know what they'll do to him and poor Archimedes.
Pau came over and pulled Jenny away from Sean.
We can't allow history to be changed, so it is best if he is eliminated along with...
He avoided looking at Archimedes.
Along with? Inquired the old man.
All the evidence of his being here, finished Pau quickly.
The noise of battle and panic was getting louder. Pau pushed Jenny down into her place in the circle, sitting on the floor. He's not one of us.
I am sorry, Sean, so very sorry, said Jenny, her face streaming with tears.
Sean stepped forward with, Jenny, don't leave me. But Pau had taken her limp, unwilling hand, inserted her egg in it, and brought it down with force in front of her,
at the same time breaking his own with his other hand in a similar fashion, while the others smashed theirs. From within each of the time fossils came a kind of swirl, hard to describe as a liquid or a gas. More a sort of galaxy in miniature, if you can imagine that, spinning ever broader and denser, mixing into one big omelette, till it enveloped all five of the Time Riders and obscured them from sight. The last Chorn saw of Jenny was her face mouthing, "So sorry, so very sorry." Then she was gone. When I say she was gone, I obviously don't mean physically vanished. Let's be clear, this is a serious story. But Jenny was no longer there. In her place was a young woman who looked very much like Jenny, just somehow not as beautiful or corporeally so perfectly steamy-lined, who got up and looked about her in surprise and wonder. She totally ignored Sean, while she did a few panicky displaced person laps of the room, before she found the door and ran out of the house, followed or preceded by the other people left behind by the emulsified consciousnesses of the Time Riders. All, that is, except one. Stinto was still there. He had his arms out and was pretending to be surfing with his eyes closed. When he opened them, he called out, "What a ride!" And then his face fell an octave, as he obviously had not expected to be still sitting cross-legged on Archimedes' floor. "What the?" Then, seeing the others had left him behind, Stinto panicked demonstrably by hunting through the scattered broken time shells, trying desperately to salvage some time liquid, but it had all evaporated. Sean stared at him. "Stinto, why are you still here?"
"I don't know. It must have been a bad egg. Are you trapped here?"
Stinto tried to calm down enough to think.
No, all I need is another egg.
Then he clicked his fingers in sudden realization of something, stood up and ran out of the house. Sean turned to Archimedes.
"I'm so sorry, Master, but..."
He indicated the way Stinto had fled.
"Yes, Sean, go. Go, my son. Go, it is your destiny. Say hello to the future for me. Ask them to think of me sometimes and to remember me kindly."
"That they will, I promise you."
"And you?"
"Yes, I will too. I will miss you terribly."
With tears beginning to rivulet down his face, Sean hugged Archimedes. Then he turned and sped after Stinto, as if his life depended on it. Which, as you will soon see, it did. Stinto had already reached the top of Eureka Arcade, and would have disappeared from sight by the time Sean had come out of the house, if he hadn't suddenly jumped and started running back down the street towards Sean.
"You have come back for me?"
called Sean happily to him.
"Like, unlikely!" screamed Stinto as he raced past him.
Then Sean saw the reason for the direction change, and it was a good one. A group of viciously armed and no-questions-ever-asked Romans had appeared in the street in pursuit. Sean caught up to Stinto just as he dived into a narrow side alley, then another, over some market stalls, and ran in the counter direction to a mass of sustainably panicked locals fleeing away from the harbour. Projectiles of flaming oil were exploding all around them and flying overhead.
"Where are you going, Stinto? The Romans are that way,"
heaved Sean, wishing Shoplift Titian had kept his body in better shape.
"I have to reach the Oracle. Strange time to ask for a reading of the future. I would have thought ours was rather obvious."
"Oh, shut up. You're not invited. Pau said you have to stay here.
But it's dangerous. Tell me about it. And chronologically inept. Why is that?"
gasped the just as unfit body Stinto was occupying without permission. Sean reasoned with him.
"Look, if I belong in the future, and you to all time, we have to live to be in the future. So how can we die here? Isn't that a time paradox? What has all this to do with a pair of socks? No, paradox. As in, you kill your grandfather and not be born so you can't travel back in time to kill your grandfather in the first, or rather, second place."
Stinto stopped suddenly.
"You're right. I can't die here."
A spear suddenly arced towards them from out of no particular where.
"Stinto," screamed Sean a warning. "It's okay, Sean, I can't."
The spear thudded into Stinto's body.
"Die here,"
and he paradoxed himself on the spot. The next thing he knew, Sean was being jumped on by a burlesque of Roman soldiers. One shook him.
"Got you."
"Get your filthy hands off me, you murderous monster."
The centurion in charge approached.
Now, there is never an excuse for bad manners, is there, men? No, never.
The men responded with strangely electronic-sounding unison. Then the centurion did the most unexpected thing. He took a helmet out of a bag he was carrying and connected it by some wires to the end of the spear projecting from Stinto's inert body. He fiddled awkwardly for a while till he got the adapters right. Then the assembly of helmet, spear, and Stinto seemed to be possessed by some mysterious special effects energy of a green, glowy, weird whistling kind. When it had faded, the body still looked like Stinto, but much less handsome and perfect somehow. The centurion unclipped the helmet and signaled to the guards behind Sean to do something. Sean woke up wet, and it had nothing to do with his dreams. A Roman soldier was walking away with a bucket swinging at his side. Another was slapping his face, not entirely unbrutally, while yet others were pulling him into a right-up position on a chair, in what turned out to be an interrogation tent, one field, canvas, brutal thug for the use of. Suddenly the soldiers were stamping about and saluting, barking instructions and replying the obvious. This was because the sinister bad guy had entered, slamming the tent flap as nastily as he could to cover all expectations. It was Cespuglio the Younger, the much-feared Roman trade delegation leader. He had one of those faces which probably inspired the invention of the punching bag, and he had chosen for this occasion a battle skirt from the serious butcher about the town range, with just enough blood spatters to suggest, without airing to ostentatious. He pulled down a soldier and sat on him opposite Sean. "So, if it isn't our old friend, Shoplift Titian." He looked up at the centurion. "Did you get it?"
"Yes, my lord."
The centurion handed him the helmet. "Is it charged?"
"Yes, my lord."
Cespuglio put the helmet on, then hunted for and found a switch somewhere at its back. His body went suddenly rigid, as the parental guidance-only glow Sean had seen pass out of Stinto through the spear, reappeared and took up residence in and around Cespuglio's face. While this was going on, Cespuglio changed somehow. He seemed much less repugnant in features. Then, after all this had stabilized, his features faded back to baseline hideous, and he smiled and spoke. "Well, well, well, how very interesting. Sean Soulpierre, are we? Of Lugano, Switzerland? Tell me, Sean, where is the watch?" "The watch? What has that got to do with anything? And what is that thing?" stammered Sean, indicating the helmet. "Oh, come now. Are you telling me you've never seen a shroud trap? A time traveller like you?" "Shroud? Is that what you call the time riders?"
"More like time hiders.
Mutants, Sean. Criminals who upset the timelines. He looked at the helmeted Roman soldiers around them. "Clients who wish to stop them." "Did you have to kill Stinto?"
"No. Unfortunately, you can't kill someone who is not alive in the sense you and I understand. But we can neutralize them."
"Does that mean capture them? With that?"
Cespuglio paradiddled the helmet with his fingers and smiled. "And with this," he put the helmet back on, "we can see the universe the way they see it. Don't you think it is interesting? Very interesting indeed."
"Stinto? Stinto, can you hear me?"
called Sean to the helmet, feeling more than a little foolish.
Cespuglio laughed cruelly. "Don't bother. The shrouds are, as I told you, not alive. They just think they are. How stupid can you get?"
Again, Chespulio's face contorted from a serial ugly to something far more in the designer line. His voice was different somehow, too.
"Sean! Sean!" said the voice. "You've got to warn the others! Warn Jenny! The invertebrates are here!"
Then, just as wrenchingly, Cespuglio made an enormous face-pulling effort and took control of his ensemble wits.
"Enough! Down, boy, down!" He relaxed suddenly. "Ah, that's better.
Not really what I had in mind. Ha! He looked at his audience of soldiers and Sean, and kicked the one he was sitting on. Get that? Not really what I had in mind? And he laughed to himself at his joke. Nah, you had to be there. He then touched his helmeted temples and spoke to his inner young adult. You behave yourself and everything will be fine. We'll have your friends in there with you soon enough. You leave my friends alone, shouted Sean. Tespulia made a sign to the guards behind Sean, the same sign as the centurion had made in the street. Oh no, not again, Sean had time to almost think. He awoke this time in a heftily mid-antiquity decor temple, large and low-budget gloomy, full of suspicious vapors, auditioning priestesses, and animals from various cost categories waiting patiently for their cue to sacrifice their all for the sake of the show. Tespulio was haggling the price or something with the famed oracle. There was stoic refusal body language in play on the oracline side, till Tespulio made his final offer of immediate indiscriminate slaughter of all present, and this seemed to swing the deal. While this was going on, a row of soldiers was concaved behind Sean's prone form, making him the main attraction of the little spectacle unfolding, although his actual consciousness did not seem to be particularly requisite. And there it was, an enormous time egg in the hands of the Oracle.
This boy has no power, proclaimed the Oracle, showing a bit of leg as part of the show, while the priestesses attempted a hastily choreographed ballet routine. The holy blood calls to him. He is drawn to the tiki-toki.
Send him to it. You men go with him. Kill him when you have the watch, ordered Tespulio to the soldiers. I will take the long way round. The oracle incantated something in ancient sacred gibberish. Then, with a last reluctant sigh at losing her chief crowd-puller, she threw the egg at Sean's feet. It cracked, and the outrush of liquid time enveloped him and the troop of Roman soldiers around him in a swirl of you really should have gone before you went.